I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Have you ever heard of a maiden's blush or a parkeroo? Have you tasted Satan's whiskers or thrown back a prairie oyster? Those are just a few of America's forgotten cocktails, and a new book has the recipes for these and 140 others. On this election day, a traditional time for celebrating with vigor or confronting one's disappointments, we talk about cocktails, past and present, what makes some great and what relegates some to history. And we'll bring in our resident wine and spirits expert, Doug Frost, to mix a few along the way. Later, Steve Kraske will join us to talk about what we should be watching tonight as results begin to pour in. It's Bottoms Up, to date, after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is crisscrossing the state with candidates today. I'm Brian Ellison. Perhaps you've seen the ad campaign by one major bourbon maker. They feature a ballot with three choices: Republican Party, Democratic Party, Cocktail Party. Today, Up to Date casts its vote for the third choice, taking advantage of Election Day to explore that great American institution, the cocktail. Past or present, history and politics and life have often been reflected in the drinks of the day. And today, we'll explore some of that variety and richness, including a few alcohol-free options. And we here in the studio, as a public service, will even try some of them to make sure they are suitable for your consumption. Later, if we are still able, we'll talk with host Steve Kraske about what to be watching for after the polls close this election night. But first, what we'll be drinking at that time later today. Leslie Bloom is author of a new book, Let's Bring Back the Cocktail Edition. It says in its subtitle, it's a compendium of impish, romantic, amusing, and occasionally appalling potations from bygone eras. Leslie, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for having me.
And she's joining us from NPR Studios in New York. Doug Frost, whom our regular listeners will know, is one of only three people in the world to hold both the titles of Master of Wine and Master Sommelier. What they may not know is that he's just as much of an expert on spirits as well. So, Doug, welcome to the program.
Well, I've drunk my fair share, that's all.
Okay, well, that, if that makes you an expert, then so be it. Throughout the morning, Doug will be offering us some suggestions. Should we get started, Doug? Do you have any suggestions you want to start us off with?
Well, absolutely. I think what's really fun for an election day, and I should preface, and Leslie, I'm sure we'll have some thoughts on this as well, is that there is a long tradition of alcohol beverage and elections. It was an easy way to make sure that the election swung your way, is making sure everybody bought a round of drinks. And really, if we go to a pre-Prohibition era, it was not unusual for those elections to happen in a bar, conveniently enough. And it's still in some states, it's not technically illegal to sort of purchase someone's vote. So, buying somebody a drink just to help them understand who the best and friendliest and nicest candidate is something that has a long tradition. So I thought we'd start out with a champagne cocktail, because it's all about the celebration.
Seems right.
Exactly. But the fun part about the champagne cocktail is that it's not just champagne. It's also sugar. You stick a sugar cube in there. And then the best part of all, really, is that then you put bitters on it. So it is all about the bittersweetness of celebration.
Right. Perfect politics drink, isn't it?
As they say, it's something you need in you deserve in victory and something you desperately need in defeat.
Well, very
That's
good.
What Napoleon said. Napoleon said, I drink to celebrate my victories and I drink to get over my defeats.
So as Doug begins to mix some drinks here for us, we are joined in the studio by Maria Carter, KCUR's morning newscaster, who has finished her shift and therefore is able to join us this morning.
I'm finishing just a little early for this.
Fair enough. So Leslie Bloom, you've written this book, which I know you didn't set out to write a history of cocktails, but they do have a rich history, don't they?
They have a pretty amazing long history, and I include anecdotal stories about cocktails dating back to Roman times, ancient Roman times. And on the earlier point that Doug was talking about the politicization in elections and cocktails, the word cocktail itself may have political connotations. One of the things I researched was the origin of the word cocktail, and a friend of mine at the Oxford English Dictionary said, look, there are 1,000 different theories, but and then he told me his favorite one. And supposedly during the Revolutionary War, an innkeeper named Betsy Flanagan poached some loyalist roosters. Roosters belonging to a local loyalist, and she pulled out all of the feathers of the cock's tail, and she served drinks with those cock feathers in them, and hence cocktail. So even the word may have political connotations at its origin.
Well, then it's even more reason that we should be doing this show today, and you're hearing
absolutely
the sounds of a champagne cocktail. If Maria, could you describe what we're seeing over there from Doug?
Well, he put the sugar cube in the bottom and then a few drops of bitters on it. And now he's filled the glass with the champagne. So the bitters, you can kind of, the sugar cube is bubbling up a little extra and you can see a little bit of color from the bitters coming up too.
Yeah. And just to be politically correct about it, this is American bubbly. Okay. We're kind of doing an American thing today as much as possible. You know, it's election day. Let's at least this one day not get in trouble for that.
I wonder what's so special about cocktails, Leslie? I mean, how is it different, you think, from just drinking beer or wine, or what's special about a cocktail?
Well, I think, you know, especially these days, wine drinking and beer drinking has become so artisanal and special, you know, in their own right. But cocktails, there's always been an artistry to it. And, you know, cocktails by definition are, you know, a liquor with a mixer, but there's also like a presentation to it and a creativity. And the man who's credited with being the father of mixology, the American father of mixology, Jerry Thomas, who lived in the mid 1800s in San Francisco, was the first person to really elevate cocktails to a high art form. And so other bartenders of that era were whiskey slingers, but Jerry Thomas would wear, you know, a pressed white shirt with diamond studs in it, and he had a bar kit that was made of sterling silver, and, you know, his drinks, you know, sometimes had flames coming out of them. He toured the European capitals to promote this art of cocktails. And so that kind of set the tone for, you know, many decades of cocktails since. And so I think people associate them with sort of a more of a presentational, celebratory art than maybe just drinking a beer more casually.
It's not just a drink. It's an event, sort of.
It can be. I mean, there are also, you know, some pretty sloppy and disgusting cocktails out there also, some of which I include in the book just for the humor value. But yes, I mean, on the whole, I think that people just consider them to be very occasion oriented.
We'll be talking about some of those particular drinks that the book highlights as we go along today. We should mention that we're going to take pictures of some of the drinks you're hearing made and hearing discussed today, and you'll be able to find those pictures on our Facebook page, KCUR. Also, we'll link to them later from the up-to-date website. So we've had a chance now to taste the you hear the sounds of a working bar in our studios here today. We've had a chance to taste this first drink from Doug Frost. Maria Carter, what did you think?
It tasted a lot like champagne to me.
That's good.
You know, I don't know. Maybe it was the bitters and the sugar kind of balancing each other out. I don't know if I would have known it was a champagne cocktail, per se. Rather than just a glass of champagne.
Take a whiff of it. And what's really fun about bitters is you know, there are many different kinds of bitters, especially these days. But just take a sniff of the thing. It has a sort of floral nose that just wouldn't be there. And that comes from the bitters, even though we think of bitters as, well, bitters and bitter and sort of, you know, made from herbs and barks and bark and such. It comes out in the champagne cocktail as sort of floral. And I think it's an intriguing smell. But best of all, because of the sugar in the bottom, the bubbles take off. And so the thing is a lot fizzier and a lot more celebratory than it might otherwise be.
We have a lot to talk about today on KCUR's Up to Date, but we want to especially invite our listeners to consider the perfect cocktail for election night. You can make your suggestions on our Facebook page. And, of course, in a few moments, we're going to introduce you a couple of election night cocktail choices, which you can even vote for. So, let's invite Doug Frost to tell us what he's making next.
Well, after having done the, you know, the champagne cocktail, which is, as I say, supposed to be all about victory, I thought I would have another celebratory cocktail, at least at one point in the world. As the story goes, December 5, 1933, after Prohibition had finally ended, that FDR celebrated by making one of his martinis and stirring it up for everybody and serving it at the White House. as if he'd been doing it this way all along. And I'm sure that's no coincidence. Now, I have to admit as well that it's kind of a disgusting martini when you get right down to it, because, or at least can we admit that it's unusual? We're going to be doing a couple ounces of gin, just like we did the bubbly was from Toad Hollow out in Sonoma. This is a gin from Death's Door, Door Peninsula, up north of here in a battleground state. And then we're going to – then he always finished it off with olive brine. So he made an original dirty martini, which my wife really digs those. What was weird about FDR's is he used a lot of vermouth. It's 2-to-1 in the vermouth, which wasn't unusual back in the 30s. But for us these days, it's like, huh? And used a healthy dose of the olive brine. And then he'd rim the glass with lemon as well. So it was kind of a mixed up, muddled mess. But it made him happy, and that's all that counted.
And we'll find out if it makes us happy.
Yes, we will.
Leslie, are you jealous that you're not here yet?
I'm ravenously jealous.
Yeah, what do you?
And you know, in FDR's defense, maybe making martinis is like getting on a bike. You just never forget how to do it.
That's it. I'm sure he remembered. So Leslie, this is an unusual drink in some ways. What are some of the more unusual drinks that you came across?
There were an astonishing array of really weird ingredients that have been used for cocktails over the centuries. And in my book, I have a list of really cuckoo things that were being used in books, in drinks from gunpowder to biscuits. Those are not drinks that I recommend recreating.
Doesn't seem safe, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would definitely be a different sort of adventure. I have to say, my goal in the book was really to create present 144 historical lost recipes that you actually really would want to recreate.
Right.
So I have to say that I hear quite a bit of activity going on in the bar over there.
It is very exciting here in the studio today.
I earned quite a few hangovers as I researched this book, because we had to test each of the recipes and adjust them for modern palates. But I would say that most of them are pretty good. There's one really bizarre drink that I included just because it was so ghastly, and I just didn't think anybody would believe that it had actually existed. And that was called the gingivitis cocktail.
Oh, yeah, I read that one and just went, huh?
Yeah, tell us about the gingivitis cocktail. I was pretty astonished as well.
Well, and I want to hear Doug's take on this, too. So I have it listed as an entry as the least appetizing drink in history. And it's it's a combination of gin, grenadine, and cream, thus evoking the components of gingivitis. I mean, how horrid is that? Somebody somewhere thought this was a grand idea to serve this up at some establishment. And, so that's out of the 144 recipes in the book, that's the only one that's really showcased to appall. But for the most part, there were some really incredible, like, delicious and gorgeous drinks that you just can't believe that have been forgotten or just are not as popular anymore. And when I was listening to Doug talk about champagne cocktails, there were two in particular that I thought were so sublime that your listeners should learn about them. The first is a diamond fizz. And gin fizzes are gin and a little bit of egg white or a whole egg, and lemon juice and sugar. And then you top it off with seltzer. But in a diamond fizz, you top it off with champagne, and it's just so unbelievably decadent. And I have in the book a recipe for a vintage raspberry diamond fizz, which is sublime. And the other one is Ernest Hemingway actually came up with this amazing drink called Death in the Afternoon, which was also the name of one of his books. And that is a champagne cocktail of champagne and absinthe. And in his prose instructions, he says, you must drink 3 to 5 of these very slowly. And you can see why it was called Death in the Afternoon, because who would be standing up after 3 to 5 of absinthe and champagne cocktails?
I have to say, one of the things I really enjoy about your book, Leslie, is that you don't just provide the recipes for the drinks, you provide the instructions for drinking them.
Well, that was all Mr. Hemingway.
So yes,
in
this case. So the gingivitis cocktail, you say, shake with ice and strain into a chilled cocktail glass, garnish with a strand of dental floss, which seems appropriate.
Did any of them come with instructions about drinking on live radio?
No. I think it's a dicey prospect anyway. So what are we enjoying now again? Remind us.
Well, we're trying to enjoy, at least based on Maria's facial remark, shall we say. That was a nice visual remark that she gave us when she tasted the famous FDR our dirty martini,
yes.
Is she's had better.
Or does she not care for dirty martinis in the first place?
You know, it, Well, you smell the lemon like very heavily on it, but then I just taste a lot of the olive in it.
Yeah.
And so it's very. You almost think you're going to get something a little bit more lemony than you do, and it threw me off.
Yes, it threw me off as well. I think that's a good read on it. And I have to say also, you used Kalamata olive brine. I can see the jar here. So it's,
I wanted to go crazy, and I definitely wanted the nice dark color for it. So that was,
it is a lovely
color. It's pretty.
Color. It's a good-looking drink, which Leslie Bloom, I think that actually seems to describe a lot of these drinks. They sound a lot better than I have to think they would taste.
Yes. No, I'd have to actually disagree. I mean, because we didn't really include anything in here that tastes bad. And some of them are like breathtakingly good when you actually make them. I mean, everything, you know, of course, everybody has, you know, different palates. But, you know, we had a cocktail launch party for the book a few weeks ago, and we recreated a bunch of the recipes, and they had hilarious names, from the monkey gland to the hanky panky and the between the sheets. And there was one that we recreated from the book's pages called the June Bride. That was so good that some people just absolutely staggered out of there. You couldn't just drink, you know, three or four. You had to really go in the other direction. It was gin, egg white, lemon juice, sugar, and elderflower liqueur. Shake it up. And, you know, so many of the drinks and vintage drinks were really about, you know, texture and personality. And I think that, again, everything is an acquired taste, but if you thumb through the book's pages, you'll look and you'll see the ingredients that you'll like, and you'll be astonished by some of the results.
Well, and speaking of ingredients, Leslie, one of the things I was struck by is that there are a lot of ingredients that perhaps have fallen out of favor in the drinks you might order in a bar today, but were quite common in a number of the drinks you included. So eggs, I noticed, came up in quite a few drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And also a liquor called Pernod, which is not unheard of today, but not nearly as common. Is that right?
Well, thankfully, it's back in the market. Pernod, the very large drinks company, did bring it back into the market. And so it's very useful. I mean, once upon a time, we used Pernod or absinthe-styled drinks to provide a lot of aroma. And for a while, the only thing left out there was Sazerac, you know, the idea that you rinse your Sazerac with some absinthe. But happily, that's changing. At the same time, I have to admit that some of us feel like there's a lot of cocktailians out there that need to know that absinthe doesn't make everything taste and smell better. It's okay to leave the absinthe at home, you know. But it's really true that once upon a time, you know, as you go through Leslie's book, you find these a style of making cocktails, particularly when you talk about using egg or milk or things like that, a style of making cocktails that wasn't sort of simply nothing more than an outgrowth from a highball. You know, once upon a time in the great dark winter of cocktails in the 70s and 80s, it was either, you know, a punky style, you know, shot, as Gary Regan likes to call it, or just something, you know, two ingredients, drink and soda that you threw together. And before that, you know, as Leslie referenced the great Jerry Thomas, he was talking about doing flaming or writing about in his cocktail book, making flaming drinks, and using egg white really stiffens the drink, provides more texture, provides richness, because these were cocktails you didn't drink quickly. These are cocktails you sat around and sipped and went, cool.
Absolutely. They were a treat. And you know, that gets back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. I mean, these are celebratory. They're little feasts in many ways. I mean, Doug, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I really like that way of putting it. I think that's a really smart way to put it.
So we want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Our guests are Leslie Bloom, the author of Let's Bring Back, the Cocktail Edition, and also Doug Frost, our own wine and spirits expert from here in Kansas City. You can be part of this conversation. You can't taste the beverages, we realize, but you can still be part of the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We especially would love to hear your suggestions for great election night cocktails. My friend Tom on Facebook suggested the Hair of the Blue Dog Democrats drink, and my friend Kim on Facebook suggested the El Presidente. She even included the full recipe with rum and curacao and vermouth. What are your favorites for election night? Call us at 816-235-2888. Do you have a favorite for election night, Maria Carter?
In the past, I've always been either working or having to get up very early, so there's not a lot of drinking for me on election night.
It's pizza and Coke
for election night.
Leslie, I'm curious. We're speaking here about the kind of the event and the activity of the cocktail and not just the drink itself. What do you think are some of the other important elements of enjoying the cocktail? Is there a certain way to drink it, to toast it, to serve it? What's most important?
I think that context is important, and I think for instance, if you're having a cocktail party, let's say you're hosting it for in somebody's honor, like it's a birthday party for somebody, then maybe to have a signature cocktail for that person. If it's a vintage one, it could be something that describes that person. So if it's a person who's naughty, you have the hanky panky, or you have somebody who's somebody who's rather short yet ambitious, you serve the runt's ambition. Something funny like that, something that matches the cocktail's name and contents to the actual event. But I think, again, what Doug and I were talking about before, I think that something that really enhances the enjoyment of a cocktail is to really be aware of the, what is going into it and treating it, each sip is its own feast, and they're not there exclusively to get you drunk. They're there to be this gorgeous experience as you're actually drinking them as well.
The runt's ambition for the curious is 2 ounces of rum, 2 ounces of gin, 2 ounces of whiskey, and 2 ounces of port and ice cubes. So it is an ambitious to get through that probably as well. Doug, what are you working on now?
Well, I thought I'd do a Ward 8. The Ward 8 is a
classic.
Yeah, it really is a great classic. And as some of our listeners know, Ryan Mabey down at Manifesto and Bo Williams, they've done a really fun version of the Ward 8 since it's a classic drink. But you've got to make it for a Kansas City ward, not the Bostonian ward that it was originally named for. I think my favorite story about all of that is that the original the candidate for whom this drink was created and after whom it was named, and which apparently with plenty of rounds of free Ward 8s was elected, turned out or turned into a staunch prohibitionist and was forever embarrassed that his ward gave the name to one of the great classic cocktails.
Maybe he had too many.
Could do that.
So we saw Doug squeezing a lemon, and he's pouring a liquor now. I can't quite make out what it is.
We got a little Four Roses bourbon working here.
Four Roses bourbon, very good. So we'll
Ward 8s are really addictive. I mean, like cuckoo addictive, and they're deceptively strong because they're so sweet. And I have to say, my husband's a big man, but this is the only drink that I've ever seen that has given that man spins.
Wow. Now, and Leslie, you intentionally didn't include drinks like the Ward 8 in your book because they've already sort of made a comeback, right?
Yeah, I think, a lot of people open the book and they expect to see some of the classics in there, so like a sidecar or a martini. The Ward 8, as you mentioned. But I tried to really focus on drinks that were genuinely lost or just really that people would not know about. And I went deep into archives to find these things and spent a lot of time with really, 1800s drinks manuals and that kind of thing, just to find the most unusual recipes.
Yeah, I think it's fun that, to your point, you don't have the sidecar in there, but you've got Between the Sheets, which is a sort of tricked up sidecar in a really cool way. It's such a unfortunately forgotten drink.
So
there are a lot of variations on martinis in here also, and there are variations on Bloody Marys. Like I have something called Red Snapper, which is the St. Regis's historical version of the Bloody Mary, or the Bullshot, which is Bloody Mary that uses beef broth instead of a tomato sauce juice. That's one thing that's interesting is to see how cocktails have evolved over the years from traditional forms into different mutations, for better or for worse. And so I do have versions of the martini, versions of the sidecar, that kind of thing in here, but under a different name and with slightly different ingredients.
Let's take a couple of calls. Pam in Lee Summit, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to ask Doug Frost for his favorite recipe for Bloody Marys.
Speaking of Bloody Marys,
wow. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to admit that I don't have one. I mean, I know that's a terrible answer, but I am. It's really true that the Bloody Mary is like one of those drinks I never fell in love with. I never drink tomato juice. I
sacrilege.
I know. I have to admit it, though. Lying is not cool.
But you
it's
have to
election
like
day.
Tomato juice to really like a Bloody Mary.
You really do. No more lies.
Way, I can't enjoy a Bloody Mary.
It's election day. No more lies. Just today, So I guess what I would say is that I do like, when I'm making one, I like a lot of horseradish. I like a lot of activity to it. I'm going to make sure that there's a little bit of of hot sauce in there because I want it to definitely, you know, glow in somebody's mouth.
Pam, what's your favorite recipe for a Bloody Mary?
Well, I would actually say I use that mixed Bing Bang.
The mix?
Yeah.
Oh, that might be sacrilege to our experts today.
No. Well, I don't know how you feel about it, Leslie. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, to my point, it's like, that's cool. You know, it's a lot of trouble to make your own, but it's kind of fun to do. I mean, you should look at it like just playing chef in the kitchen. On the other hand, there are times when, you know, you need a Bloody Mary. You don't have a lot of time on your hands, and you need it right now.
We want to discourage that way of drinking Bloody Marys, by the way, here at KCUR. What was that, Leslie?
I think that it's fine to use a standard mix, but then there are ways that you can, you know, really mix it up. And, you know, so for instance, maybe you could serve it with, you know, some really wonderful artisanal pickle a spear of pickle instead of the spear of celery in it, or just experiment with the spices and just really make it into your own. And Pam, if you check out my book, there's one really good recipe in here for the Red Snapper, which was an early version of the Bloody Mary. That's quite heavy on the spices, and I think that maybe it would be fun for you as a fan of the Bloody Mary to recreate these different versions.
It's important to be creative, exactly as Leslie's saying. You know, and you don't have to stop at anything. Any vegetables will go in there at all.
And, right. And olives, can,
yeah,
delicious.
Yeah, exactly. It's great fun to turn it into a salad and no longer have worry too much about it being a drink.
Yeah, the guilt-free Bloody Mary. You're getting your vegetables, your salad while you're guzzling booze.
On the Ward 8, Maria Carter, how do you vote?
I would vote yes on Ward 8.
I think I would too. This one's a winner, Doug.
Would you vote early and often like they do in Chicago, or would you actually have your vote counted like they don't in Florida?
Oh, well, now see, we can't go there. This is election day. Let's take a couple more quick calls here. Bill in Lawrence, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. What's your recommended drink for election day?
Well, I think an old fashioned has to be my answer to the problem.
A true classic. Why would you choose that one, Bill?
Well, because they don't make them the way they're supposed to anymore. You're supposed to put a nice sugar cube in the bottom and put some bitters on it, and then muddle it out, and then put some rye whiskey, not bourbon, rye whiskey, and then throw some ice in and put enough water in to get up to the top, and then put an orange slice in, and don't muddle the orange and the cherry like they tend to want to do now. I don't know why Doug would let them do that in Kansas City, but that's what they seem to want to do.
Leslie, he's a purist. What do you think of that?
I'm all for purism. But, I mean, everything, at the end of the day, cocktail drinking is, it's all about personal preferences. And, you know, if you know the perfect way for you to make that drink, then that's what you should stick with. And you should instruct your bartenders also. That said, I'm also for experimentation. And, you know, as we have seen over decades, you know, many cocktails have evolved because a bartender has muddled something that he or she should not have and has turned it into a slightly different variation that may or may not have appealed to, you know, other drinkers. So I think it's sometimes there's no substitute for a strictly made classic cocktail, and sometimes you want to fancy it up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. As Leslie is saying, it is, you know, that's one of those drinks that really evolved, and it evolved in the 50s and 60s as we were coming back, you know, and returning to the idea of a cocktail, although it's only been in the last 10 or 20 years that we've really embraced it. But prior to that, you know, the old-fashioned, that's usually the terminology we'll use. And so when you're drinking in Kansas City and you order an old-fashioned, you have to say, I want an old-fashioned. And if not, they'll give you the new-fashioned old-fashioned, which is with the muddled fruit. So it became, you know, went from a very classic characteristic of cocktail, which is basically booze and something sweet and something bitter, and we're done. Because once upon a time, you know, the cocktail, the first notice that we have it is, I believe, 1806 in the Hudson Valley, and they talk about it being a bittered sling. And so it was something that was boozy with a little bit of sugar added, and then it was bittered up. And so that's the old-fashioned, and then the new-fashioned old-fashioned is like a whiskey smash. So we began to say, hey, let's throw some fruit in there. More people will like it. It'll be easier and friendlier and maybe appeal to more folks. But I'm with you on this one, man. Rye whiskey and, you know, just the sugar cube and the bitters, and I'm in heaven.
Let's quickly take one more call from Paul in Lenexa. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
What's your drink suggestion?
Well, I just came across something a little unusual and had a pretty unique flavor to it, and it's a mix of some liqueurs as opposed to liquor, but it's a half ounce each of black Sambuca, blackberry brandy, and amaretto, and then ounce and a half of light cream shaken over ice and served, and they call it a double black and cream, but very interesting combination of flavors, and that comes off, and very aromatic, of course, the black Sambuca, the licorice, the nut from the amaretto. So I'm from New York, and they do all kinds of strange stuff out there, of course.
and Leslie Bloom, who is joining us from New York, can probably confirm that, right, Leslie?
Absolutely. As one of the strangest New Yorkers out there, I can absolutely confirm that.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, and it's tough to get a break in today because we're having such a good time. But when we come back, we'll have more talk about great cocktails of the past and the present. And we take your calls, your Facebook posts, your emails. We'll talk about some of the great places in town for cocktails, and we'll even have some non-alcoholic options, too. I'm Brian Ellison, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, who will be joining us in a few minutes to talk about what to watch for on election night. If you missed yesterday's conversation about a program reducing recidivism rates and making prisoners more productive members of Kansas society, you can find that with all our other shows at kcur.org. Also tomorrow, Steve Kraske will be back with the political pundits to wrap up everything that happens tonight. You won't want to miss that tomorrow on Up to Date. But today we're talking with Leslie Bloom, the author of Let's Bring Back, the Cocktail Edition, and Doug Frost, our own master of wine and spirits here on KCUR. Maria Carter of the KCUR news team is here to assist us in objective assessment of the quality of cocktails, past and present, that we're mixing up here in our studios today. You can be part of the conversation by calling 816-235-2888 with your questions or comments, your own suggestions for favorite election night cocktails. And we are about to introduce a new feature here, the 2012 Election Cocktail Face-Off. Doug Frost is mixing the first candidate right now. Doug, what do you have to offer?
Well, this is, of course, inspired by that wonderful little Colorado girl who was so fed up with everything that was happening with the with all of the attack ads and such that she began weeping and has become famous ever since. And so I thought after she called him Bronco Obama, it made sense somehow as a Coloradoan that she had allied him with the local team. And come on, he's a Democrat. So it made a lot of sense. And so when I was trying to figure out what drink do I make for Barack Obama to represent him, of course, it has to be a mule. The mule is a classic drink that utilizes ginger beer and basically any other booze, although we've seen it with the Moscow Mule, with vodka. We've seen it with rum as a dark and stormy and such. So this one's going to be made, however, and I'm sorry, this is intentional. This is made with a product called Kansas Whiskey, which is, can I just say for the record, not at all from Kansas. Yes. And if you want to take something from that, you can take from that whatever you wish. It's actually made in New York. And but nonetheless,
Kansas is just so cool.
They had to name their whiskey after us.
The other Manhattan, perhaps.
Yes, I guess that was it. But at the same time, I'm sorry to some degree,
called Kansas, but it's not really from Kansas.
That's
your
correct.
Point. That's very clever, Doug.
I'm sorry. I just thought it would be fun. That's all. And so we're gonna use that whiskey. We're gonna use basically Domaine de Canton as our ginger. Now, I probably should have gone to the trouble of making a ginger syrup, but I played around with this a little bit, and I liked the sugar that this brought, and thought it would be a bit more fun. But we're gonna have to play around with the recipe just to get it quite right, just like the political teams do every night, I'm sure, as they talk about each performance. So that's going to happen. And then we're going to finish it off with not ginger beer. Barack Obama's a beer guy, and he makes beer. And so we're going to finish it with Boulevard.
Right.
Of course.
He's
we
actually
have
made
to.
Beer at the White House.
Yes, exactly. Right. Which, of course, as you can imagine, I think is extremely super cool. So we're going to finish it with our own local heroes, Boulevard Pale Ale. So you're going to have to bear with me for a second while I mix all this up. It's a slightly complicated drink, but we're almost there.
A little later, we'll be posting pictures of the two competing drinks on our Facebook page, and our listeners will be able to vote because it is after election day. Leslie, Doug is inventing a cocktail. Is there a rich heritage of cocktail invention? Can anybody do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there was this great quote that I came across by one drink historian, and it was said that, you know, so many drinks over the years have been, you know, invented on the spot and forgotten just as quickly. And, you know, some of them have been named for the person who just happened to be sitting at the bar at the exact moment that you know, person, the bartender happened to be shaking up the cocktail. So, yeah, I mean, I think that so many cocktails over the years have just been sheer experimentation. Some of them have taken off and some of them have just slipped into oblivion, whether deservedly or not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like your caller earlier who was talking about how he likes a really strict old-fashioned, you know, somebody who does a variation on that could come across something, you know, extremely successful and delicious that makes that into the next generation of new old-fashioned. So anybody can make a new cocktail. Anybody can name it. Not everybody will make it into eternal cocktail history, but that's almost beside the point.
Leslie, why do you think some do make it? Is it just because they taste better, or are there other factors?
I think there are probably a lot of factors. I think, you know, some of them just really resonate with the time or become to symbolize a period of time in which they were made. And, you know, some it's curious. Like, for instance, nobody knows the origin of some of the mainstay classic drinks, like the martini, for instance. You don't know where it came from, so you don't know exactly why it became, you know, so popular. But then, you know, some drinks that are variations on the classics but still distinctive enough to stand on their own right, they come into being and they just disappear after a while. And nobody knows why. Maybe it's because, you know, there was a war after, or a depression after they were invented, and people just stopped drinking them. And by the time the troubles were over, you know, society had moved on and just kind of forgotten them. So context is everything. And, you know, tastes change with the times also. You know, some things that were popular during one period may be totally gross to the following generation. So it's kind of a crapshoot that involves many different factors, I think.
So we have now sampled the Bronco Bomba here in the KCUR studios. Maria Carter took a second sip and then a third. Maria?
I was trying to – I saw Doug Frost put the lime in the bottom of the drink and then, you know, and it was all mixed up, and then pour the beer on top. I didn't really get the lime at first, and so – I kind of had
you
to
went
keep
looking
on drinking.
For it.
Yeah, it's very much a drink where, you know, you
it
top
changes.
It. Yeah, it does. It will change on you a bit. Now, it's served in a Collins glass, so really, ideally, you would go ahead and mix it. But it was looking so pretty the way it was separating a little bit. I thought, oh, let them play with it a bit, as I often do when I have a dark and stormy.
So what do you think, Maria?
I liked it. You know, at first it was more just like I was just getting the pale ale aspects.
Right.
Yeah. But then, you know, I got the lime kind of coming up through there and provided a nice tartness.
Yeah, I'd go with a little more of the ginger, but it's a tasty, refreshing drink.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think ginger syrup is probably what I need to finish this thing off
with. I could have used more ginger. I love ginger.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, and of course, you know why I went with ginger, because it's this exotic Asian element. So I think this drink is at least on some level, I hope you'll allow that it's a fun and slightly irreverent depiction of the current president and his background and some of the mythology that people have, you know, brought forward as they've been frustrated at times by you know, a difference in politics. The other drink, the Mitt Romney drink, let's face it, it can't have any alcohol in it.
Right.
It can't have any coffee in it. It can't have any tea in it. So I kind of sat in my chair for a long time and went, what the heck am I supposed to do with this? So I went Ovaltine. You know,
that's so fantastic.
Well, you know, it's like, what could I do? So, and actually what I wanted was Postum, because apparently Postum was a source of some caffeine, even though it was from grain. And so it was quite a favorite, but Postum disappeared and Ovaltine, did as well, but it's back. And so we did, basically we did Ovaltine and some mint syrup and some mint and shaved a little cinnamon on top of it and some, a little bit of milk, to finish it off. And we call that a warm mint mittens.
Warm mint mittens.
happens.
Leslie, I bet you're really sorry you're not here enjoying these beverages.
I'm jealous.
Well, next time we'll fly you out for this show.
Yeah, I feel very deprived.
As we finish mixing the warm mint mittens, I'm curious, Leslie, where your book, which is a lovely book to look at as well as to read, is this sort
Thank
of
you.
Old-timey looking book. Where did you find these recipes? Where how in the world do you find these?
Oh, heavens, I found them in a multitude of places. I live in Manhattan's Greenwich Village, and I was lucky because there happened to be a couple of really old-school vintage cookbook and drink stores. And so the proprietors of those stores let me lurk around there for hours digging through all of these historical books. A couple of archives and also the New York Public Library has a really incredible collection of vintage menus that go back to the 18th century. You know, so I could look up and see what, you know, cocktail was served at a reception for Theodore Roosevelt. And so really research from a wide variety of places. And I do have to say, on the note of the mittens drink, you know, it's been so amusing to hear Doug find ingredients for these cocktails that match personalities. And traditionally that has been, you know, done for many, many decades. And a lot of historical drinks that were named for personalities always had an ingredient or two that really defined that person. So, for instance, I'm looking at one from my book called The Mae West. You know, for those of you who don't remember Miss West, she was a really bodacious, very bawdy, blonde bombshell, wisecracking old Hollywood star. And she could be pretty naughty. And she actually got banned once from NBC Radio because she was so scandalous during an interview. So the drink that honors her was brandy, egg yolk, sugar, and then they put a dash of cayenne pepper because she was so spicy. Exactly. So I really love drinks that have those kinds of personality elements to them.
Your instructions on the drink say add the dash of cayenne pepper and a dollop of naughtiness. my favorite drink in your book, for the record, on the subject of ingredients that fit a personality, is the mother-in-law cocktail. You say you found it in a book from 1869. You can serve it to the mother of your husband or wife and smolder with impish satisfaction as she sips it, or guzzle it yourself to recover from the latest obligatory visit. Here it is, one part old ale, one part bitter ale. Mix and pour. I think it's an excellent drink.
That, Brian, it's my one of my favorites in the entire book, and I've came across that in a falling apart ancient old book called Cooling Cups and Dainty Drinks from 1869, and I was alone in this dusty archive when I saw that, and I was hooting and snickering with laughter. So many of these vintage cocktails have so much personality, and they're naughty. A lot of them are really mischievous, and so it was really funny to come across some like that were created by some impish bartender of bygone eras.
Let me take a couple more quick calls. We've got Rebecca in Olathe. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning. Wanted to ask you guys if you'd heard of a drink called the Widowmaker. It's a terrible name, but I have to admit it was delicious. I had it at Starker's about a year or so ago, and it was amazing. And, of course, the ingredients were in the menu, but I don't recall any of them.
Do we know the Widowmaker, Doug?
No, I don't. Not offhand. Leslie, any luck?
I don't know it either. Although I've always heard that referred, I've always heard the Widowmaker as being like a triple cheeseburger. So I wish I knew what was in that drink. I do have to say I have a page in the book devoted to vintage drinks named after widows. It's really weird how many historical drinks there are that have the word widow in it. So we have, you know, the Merry Widow cocktail, the Widow's Kiss cocktail, the Widow's Dream cocktail. So I guess, you know, in the popular imagination of yesterday's bartenders, widows were quite alcohol-oriented.
My wife is known as Wine Widow. So, it didn't necessarily mean that the husband had been deceased. Merely missing, I think. They're exactly. I think you have the Black Widow in there as well, which is the rum creamed mint drink.
Yes.
And maybe that's where the Widowmaker came from. I'm not sure. I'm going to have to work on that one.
Let's take one more from Paul in St. Joe. Paul, good morning.
Hey, how's it going? Enjoying the show.
Good.
Just wanted to bring up an old one, very simple. It used to be back here for many years, it was illegal to serve alcohol until the polls closed.
Huh.
So many of the bars would serve what they called the Election Day Special, which was a simple, decent coffee
with a couple of shots of really good bourbon added. And that was quite popular for several years.
Just like the waiters in many restaurants, you would drink all your drinks out of a coffee cup, and
yes,
no one needed to be the wiser.
Bourbon in a coffee cup, and every once in a while the sheriff would wander by, and there'd be a bunch of guys sitting in the bar with coffee cups.
Well, Paul, thanks so much for that call. Maria Carter, any last thoughts about drinks for election night?
Well, I would, if I did not have to wake up very, very early tomorrow morning, I'd probably drink one or two more Ward 8s later tonight.
Doug, any last thoughts?
Well, yeah, my last thought is always is the same, which is this is great fun, but let's remember, you know, what's happened in the East Coast, and hopefully people can help people overcome Hurricane Sandy as soon as possible. And in their honor, if they're having trouble getting to the polls, make sure you get to the polls.
And Leslie Bloom, any last suggestions for election night from you?
Well, I mean, I suppose it depends on who wins, how much I'll be celebrating one way or another, whether I'll be drinking to console myself or to celebrate. But, you know, no matter what, there will be people. 50% of the country will be celebrating tonight, and 50% of the people will be drowning their sorrows. And I suggest that they consult my book for a variety of ways to help them along in either incidents.
Doug, let me ask you one more question. If folks are not at home watching the election, Kansas City is rich with a few good places to get creative cocktails, even some that are blasts from the past. Do you have any suggestions for places folks might find good cocktails in Kansas City?
Oh, absolutely. And immediately I'm going to feel guilty because I'm going to leave somebody out, and I feel awful about this, but Manifesto and the Rieger Hotel have been benchmarks for a lot of people, but you can find great cocktails in this town in some of the some of the great restaurants here, like Extra Virgin and Michael Smith and Justice Drugstore and Blue Stem, and as I say, I'm going to leave somebody out. We've referenced Starker's, certainly, and M&S. And, there's really so many great places in this town now. This town has turned into a serious, serious cocktail town, as has been evidenced by a lot of the media paying attention. And I think it's because there's a lot of really smart and good people trying to make things happen.
Doug Frost is a master of wine and a master sommelier and also our resident spirits expert. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. And don't forget the American. Sorry, I forgot the American.
And the American. All right. And Leslie Bloom, author of Let's Bring Back the Cocktail Edition. Leslie, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a delight.
And Maria Carter, honorable taster, thank you.
Thanks.
And joining us now is Steve Kraske, the host of this show, who's out covering politics today for the Kansas City Star. Steve, good morning.
Brian, good morning to you.
I first of all want to say thank you for being gone the day that we do a show about cocktails.
I'm sorry I had to miss it, that's for sure.
Hey, thanks for taking a few minutes with us. We've all seen the way that presidential candidates crisscross Virginia and Ohio and North Carolina the last couple days. What's the Missouri and Kansas equivalent of that? What are the candidates doing today?
Well, probably not a whole lot in Kansas, Brian. There's not much of a campaign there in terms of statewide officials, really nothing going on in Kansas along those lines. In Missouri, probably the closest thing you'll find to it, I mean, races for governor, races for the U.S. Senate, those candidates have been barnstorming the state pretty regularly. I covered Senator McCaskill yesterday, and she was in four or five cities throughout the day, just a classic old-fashioned barnstorm, made a stop in at her headquarters on 63rd Street, then went up to Clay County. So a lot of crisscrossing the state here at the end, which is what you got to be doing.
The wild card in these last few days of the election campaign was that Senator McCaskill also had to attend a funeral, her mother's funeral, and you might have thought that would throw a candidate way off in the days up to an election. What was the impact it had on the McCaskill campaign?
Well, we don't know for sure until we see the polls tonight and how they finish. Almost everyone agrees that the Senate race has closed and narrowed a little bit in Missouri, Brian. Senator McCaskill up double digits probably two and a half weeks ago. It's somewhat less than that today. How much of that is due to the loss of her mother? It's pretty hard to quantify that. But by all means, losing Betty Ann McCaskill, it took Senator McCaskill off the campaign trail for a good 10 days there down the stretch. Really, the final week of Betty Ann McCaskill's wife, Senator McCaskill all but virtually off the trail. And some of that, too, the following week when the funeral occurred and everything else. But I've got to tell you, I attended the funeral in St. Louis for a story I'm doing for the paper, and it was a sensational funeral, just a terrific send-off to Betty Ann McCaskill, who Senator McCaskill often referred to her as her secret weapon, and just a joyous, very upbeat funeral, which is exactly what Betty Ann McCaskill would have wanted.
I'm curious where you will be tonight as the election returns come in.
Well, I'm going to try and be where the action is tonight. I'll be stationed in Senator McCaskill's headquarters in St. Louis and ready to bounce over to Todd Akin's party if the race gets real close. But, yeah, in St. Louis, that race, the Senate race, Brian, has just blocked out the sun on so many levels since the campaign began. So much attention devoted to Todd Akin, to Claire McCaskill, that the other races in Missouri just struggled to get a whole lot of attention.
We should mention that KCUR will be bringing you special coverage tonight, beginning at 7 o'clock from NPR News. Steve Bell and I will be covering things here at KCUR, and we'll have reporters around the area, Alana Gordon, Dan Verbeck, Frank Morris, Laura Ziegler. Steve, we hope to check in with you as well. What should we be watching as we catch those first election returns?
Well, I think if you want to see where the presidential race is in Missouri, watch Clay County. Those returns typically come in early. It's a great bellwether county for the presidential race. For the race for Senate, maybe a little more complicated. St. Louis County comes in late, but that will probably really tell the tale of the tape. Clay County, Platte County, in the Kansas City area, Cass County, more and more swing districts. They'll be interesting to watch as well. Keep in mind, it's probably going to be a situation where Todd Akin may even be ahead early on as the roll returns come in, but then later on as the night progresses, the guessing line here is that Senator McCaskill will be in good shape and moving ahead at that point.
And President Obama reelected?
Well, boy, what a classically close race, Brian. That's the betting line, but it's going to be a long night.
Steve Kraske, host of this program, reporter as well for the Kansas City Star, thanks for taking a few minutes with us.
Always glad to do it, Brian.
Talk to you tonight. You can find more information about our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, Steve will be back with our pundits to discuss what the election results mean for Kansas, Missouri, and the rest of the country. The show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. We'll see you tonight with our election coverage that starts at 7. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.